You're listening to the Rua Space Podcast.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Rua Space Podcast, where we help you make space for the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in your everyday life. I'm Phil, and today I am really excited to be joined once again by author David Cole, also known as Brother Cassian, to talk about his book, Celtic Lent, 40 Days of Devotions to Easter. Now, many of you may have listened to my previous conversation with David coming on the podcast. Highly recommend it. You don't need to have listened to that one in order to engage this conversation here today, but it is such a blessing to have David back on the podcast. And of course, this episode is releasing during Lent. You don't need to listen to it during Lent because honestly, his book is great any time of the year. But if you are listening during Lent, I do highly recommend go check out the link to the book below. You can continue to engage the devotions in this book for the rest of Lent. I know that I have really enjoyed them, and I believe they can be an encouragement to you during this season. Now, before we do jump into that conversation, I just want to share a few of the things that we have going on here at Rua Space. First, during Lent, we are releasing a People of Lent series on Patreon, where we are looking at different people in the story of Jesus' last days, death, and resurrection, and what their story might mean for our story today. So it's sort of like a mini sermon slash Bible study with a guided meditation. And of course, on Patreon, we have many other series as well. Imaginative prayer, many different types of prayer, such as expounding prayer, Lectio Divina. We have a whole series of 14 days of prayer. We do a live event every month. We have a series on Psalm 23, Revelation, and more. So you can find a link to that in the description below. For just $5 a month, you help support the podcast, the ministry, and gain access to all of those series. You don't have to go through them while they are being released. When you become a member, you gain access to the entire library of all the series and practices. I am now also offering one-on-one spiritual direction, which is a beautiful space to explore your story, where God has moved and spoken in the past, where God is moving in your life and speaking to you today and what that means for the future. This space is a great place to explore spiritual disciplines, to explore different spaces in your life where you may be struggling or you may be experiencing a lot of joy. You don't have to be like going through something to enter into spiritual direction. But I've seen a lot of growth. It's a really great space to sort of walk on the faith journey with someone else. So if that's of interest to you, I do free phone calls to discuss what it might look like. And you can sign up for one below or just shoot me an email at connect@ruaspace.com. And then finally, friends, we do have our Christian yoga memberships. You can find free classes on YouTube, but in the memberships, we have over 100 videos, all designed to help you stretch your body, stretch your faith, become more present, pray, meditate. And this is a powerful practice that has meant a lot in my own life. It has helped me not only be more healthy and feel better, but has really opened up a lot in terms of what I feel, in terms of how I experience God. And so that is why we have those memberships. So you can also find a link to those in the description below. So friends, with all of that said, thank you so much for being here today. I pray that my conversation with David Cole is a blessing, a challenge, and an encouragement. David Cole, welcome back to the Rua Space Podcast. Such an honor to get to spend more time with you today.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for the invite back again. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you had been on the podcast a number of months back, and we spoke about one of your other books. And today, this is, of course, being released during Lent. And so your book, Celtic Lent, 40 Days of Devotions to Easter, really jumped out to me. And for those of you who listened to that previous episode, welcome back. And those who didn't, I do highly recommend going and listening to it. But in case this is your first introduction to David Cole, David, can you share just for a minute about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, thank you, Phil. So my name is David Cole, but I also am part of a Celtic-inspired new monastic order in which I'm known as Brother Cassian. So I tend to go by that name, particularly in work and ministry contexts, although David Cole is what's on the books. But Brother Cassian is generally what I'm known as by folks who talk with me. So the community of Aidan and Hilda is the new monastic order I belong to. We're a completely dispersed order, which means we live in our own spaces and we're all self-sufficient. We don't have a monastic center. It's great. So if you want to look that up, would be great to connect with you. But also I run my own ministry called Waymark Ministries. And that really is a ministry to try and create the opportunity for people to engage with the message of the Christian faith, maybe slightly outside of what they're used to in traditional church. I teach a lot from the contemplative and mystic traditions of the Christian faith, and also on Celtic Christianity as well. And I do that in various ways, courses, retreats, books as well, as we're talking about today.
Yeah, Celtic Christianity has been something that I've been exploring more a lot recently. Some of Christine Walter Paintner's work. And I was hoping maybe you could share with us a little bit sort of the distinctiveness of Celtic Christianity, because, you know, with our modern church and the way that we sort of gather, there's all these components to a worship service today. And many of them, I think, are honestly unhelpful, but we trace them back to Constantine and the early Roman church. And of course, not necessarily just meaning Roman Catholic, but literally Rome. But Celtic Christianity sort of developed a little separate from that, right? And so it has some distinctives and there's some really great components to it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're going to have to stop me if I get going to a bit too much, because I love the history of this and you've asked me that question. So if I'm still going in about an hour, then stop me.
Yeah, no, go for it. Let's do it.
So there's a slightly different flavor to what's now called Celtic Christianity. It never had that term historically, but we call it that now just for the ease of understanding what we're talking about. So really, everything we have in the Western church, like you said, is a heritage, is descendant, for want of a better term, of the kind of the Latin church. I tend to use the term Latin church rather than Roman church, even though it was the Roman church, because people misunderstand what we're talking about. We think we're talking about the Roman Catholic church,
right,
which is really the Roman Catholic church as we know it came in the kind of in the British history, the post-Norman period. So only within the last 1,000 years or so was it really the Roman Catholic church as we know it now. So I tend to use the term Latin church, the Western church even, perhaps. So we have that here. That's our heritage. But the Celtic church or Celtic Christianity was equally as influenced as from the Western church as it was from the Eastern Orthodox church. So there's a bit of a mix of theologies. There's quite a difference in some of the theologies between Eastern Orthodoxy and Western, both Protestant and Catholic churches. Some of that includes things like the connection with nature, which comes from the concept of the original sin, which the Western church had and the Eastern Orthodox church didn't and still doesn't have. So that sense of God's presence in nature was really quite evident in the Eastern church and therefore in the Celtic church, whereas the separation between physical and spiritual came through Augustine of Hippo and others in the Latin church. And also because the Celtic church particularly grew up in Wales and Ireland. And although Wales in itself was physically occupied by the Roman Empire, its spirituality really seemed to stick in with its Celtic roots. And of course, Ireland was never conquered by the Roman Empire, so it never had the heavy influence of the Roman church that the rest of Britain and Northern Europe had. So we have these different stances, different ways of seeing things, different ways of expressing the Christian faith, particularly through the Irish and the Welsh, where we were interacting a lot for a number of years. And most significantly, it was the post-Columba period that really influenced the British Isles. So we're talking bits of history pre-5th century, 6th century, but really most of the history is 6th century onwards. For the majority of Celtic Christianity that's known now. And one of the differences was that just like the Eastern Orthodox Church still is now, Celtic Christianity was completely monastic in its setup. So whereas the Latin Church was set up in the parochial church kind of setup, where there's a parish and there's a church and a bishop and kind of, you know, what we might now call vicars and kind of taking over, looking after the churches, in a particular area, Celtic Christianity, like the Eastern Orthodox Church, was completely monastic based. So it was all based around the hub of a community rather than the center of a church. And Celtic monasteries looked a bit more like an Iron Age community than they do the kind of the later post-medieval, post-Norman monasteries that you might be more used to with things like Cadfael and things like that. You might know that kind of that cloistered, shutting away monastery. So they looked more like a community. They had the chlan around the edge, which is the Welsh word for the borders, the outside borders of the monastic centre. And then the just inside that was the kind of the community of workers, so the shepherds and the blacksmiths and the farmers and stuff like that, and the people who make the clothes and stuff like that. And then inside there you had the lay brothers and sisters, and inside that you had the first order brothers and sisters. Many of them were mixed as well, brothers and sisters in there. And right at the centre, the hub was the monastic centre, the chapel and things like that. So there's a few differences, some similarities, but you know, enough differences for some of the historians like Thomas O'Loughlin to say, you know, there was a distinct enough difference to be able to say it was probably, it wasn't the Latin church, it was something different. And part of that is because it was influenced by the Eastern church as well.
And I think that's something that's really helpful, right? Because there's always a danger when we get stuck in one lane and everybody is sort of in one tradition, one understanding, one perspective. I really appreciate, as someone getting into, you know, deeper and deeper and teaching contemplative practices, to have another tradition that wasn't, not to say they didn't interact or weren't influenced in any way, shape, or form, but has this sort of separate track with the same fundamentals. I think that's really powerful to learn from, to sort of explore what they were doing. And one of the people who I would love to talk to, who went to talk about, that you mentioned in your book was Hilda. So could you maybe share a little bit about who Hilda was, a little of her story? And then I think there's a few kind of interesting offshoots that we could take from there.
Yeah, well, Hilda is a wonderful example of Celtic Christianity because I have had people say to me, why would I be interested in Celtic Christianity? I'm not Irish, or I'm not Scottish, or whatever it is, have none of that descent. But actually, Celtic Christianity is an expression of the Christian faith. And Hilda's a great example, because Hilda had no Celtic blood in her family line. She was an Angle. She was one of the Angles, as in the Anglo-Saxons. From what we gather from Bede, who is a 7th, 8th century historian, a monk from Northumbria, is that Hilda was part of the royal family of the East Anglian royal family in Britain. So the part that kind of the big lump that comes off the eastern coast that's got Norfolk and places like that in it. So Hilda was a princess in that royal family, not in line for the throne necessarily, but certainly one of the princesses there. And Bede tells us she lived her life in two halves. And we know that she died somewhere in her mid-60s. So probably the first 30 years, she lived as a princess. And in her teens, she was baptized with her uncle Edwin, who was the king of Northumbria, with a Latin church bishop, because the Celtic Christians had been kind of pushed out a little way by the Romans. So the Roman missions had come in into the south, and she was baptized as a Roman Christian with her uncle Edwin. But then about a generation later, so Edwin was killed in battle and his nephew Oswald took over the throne of Northumbria. Oswald invited a group of monks from Iona, where he'd been kept safe during the wars, to come over to Lindisfarne, or to come over to Northumbria. They founded a monastery on Lindisfarne and do a mission around his lands. So Aidan was the one who kind of set up the successful mission. And Hilda and Aidan encountered one another. And it's a wonderful story that it kind of shows that there must have been something in Celtic Christianity. This is one of the things that gives us the idea that there's a slight difference. Because when Hilda met Aidan, she changed the way she lived her Christian faith. So she became like a disciple of Aidan. She came, we might say now, this term obviously wasn't used historically, but she became a Celtic Christian rather than a Roman Christian. So there was something in it, or something in Aidan as a person, that resonated with her, different to the Romanized Christianity that she'd been brought up with. And then she was given some land to create a monastic center. Somewhere on the River Weir, which is in the north, we don't know exactly where, and then a bigger one in Hartlepool, and then the biggest one that she ran right to the end of her life in her 60s in Whitby. And so Hilda was an incredibly important person in the fact that she was firstly an Angle, secondly, she had been converted to Roman Christianity and then changed her expression to the Celtic Christians, and then became one of the most significant and influential monastic leaders of her time. And so a very important woman.
Is there a teaching of hers that, you know, has really resonated with you, that stands out as something that impacts the way you express and live out your faith?
There's nothing of her specific teachings that exist in the sense of a written word, like a primary source, like we have the sermons of Columbanus, the 7th century Irish bishop. But we do get an incredible sense of her life and what kind of a person she was. So she became known colloquially as the mother of the church because of her kind of mothering instinct over the people. We know that people from peasants to royalty came to her for spiritual wisdom and advice. Mm. And we know that she encouraged this young guy called Cadmon, who the story goes that they used to do a traditional kind of Anglo-Saxon Celtic pastime called passing the harp, which was literally passing a kind of a bardic lap harp around the community, and everyone would kind of twinkle it a little bit. Everyone knew how to get a vague song or tune out of the harp in those days, and sing a song or tell a story, and Cadmon would run away because he couldn't sing and he couldn't remember the songs and all these things. He'd get embarrassed. And then he had a dream one night, and God gave him this dream of creation. He created a song out of it. He started singing it, and Hilda encouraged him. And then he wrote those things down. He had more dreams, more songs came, and he wrote them down. And that was the first time that any of the Bible stories had ever been written in English. So they'd been written in Latin up until that point, and then Cadmon wrote it in his colloquial Angle language. So Hilda's encouragement of Cadmon meant that this is the first time any of the Bible had been written down in English. In the 7th century. So just her character of love and hospitality and acceptance, but also, you know, you don't go to someone for spiritual advice, particularly if you're, you know, some kind of royalty or nobility who's just going to give you platitudes. You know, we don't get that sense from her. She really, you know, she wouldn't hold her punches if that's what she thought was needed.
Yeah. Well, and it stands out to me, you know, in one of the chapters, of course, the book, you have 40 different days of devotions with stories and insights and prayers and such. And one of the questions you ask in relation to Hilda is, what are you willing to lay aside to become closer to God? Are you willing to lay aside the way you currently live the Christian life if you felt another way resonated with you more? And sort of the story of her going from being a princess to this sort of monastic woman, this leader. And I think for me, that's one of the reasons I've turned to spiritual disciplines is, you know, you've sort of got these two sides of things. You know, I want to make changes, but don't know how. And lots of people teaching spiritual disciplines like contemplative prayer and centering prayer, fasting, all these things. But I think sometimes people are like, well, what do we do those for? Just for the sake of doing it? Is it just supposed to be something I'm supposed to do? And there's this connection between them that if we're going to change our lives, we have to change our habits. We have to change the ways that we're being formed. So I think that was a powerful question. Are we willing to change? And then I think another part of it would be, how do we sort of go about making that change? Because it's not just something we can decide in our minds, right? It's not usually that easy.
Well, no, I think it starts with the cognitive decision of I want to do this. But the practice is what actually changes us. It's about changing your behavior. And that's about shifting the way your brain works and how it's wired. So this is what's called white martyrdom. It's the story of Hilda that I have in the Celtic Lent book is on the week of examples from Celtic saints of white martyrdom. So there's a book called the Cumbrae Homily, which I think is we're on the as we're speaking today. It's Thursday, the day after Ash Wednesday, and I think it's today actually in the book. But it talks about the Cumbrae Homily, which talks about three types of martyrdom, and they're given colours. So red martyrdom is what we'd normally associate with martyrs, you know, dying physically for your faith. You've given your life up physically for your faith. And then they talked about white martyrdom and green martyrdom. And white martyrdom, of course, is what Hilda was doing. So white martyrdom was to give up entirely your lifestyle for the faith and for Christ. So she gave up being a princess for the sake of Christ and became, you know, the leader of a monastic center. Others did the same sort of thing as well. Cuthbert, another great example of an angle who gave up his lifestyle. He was a noble to become a monk living in a monastic center. And then, of course, there's green martyrdom, which is about living according to a set of spiritual discipline or a rule of life. So this is about giving up your freedom of wanting to do whatever you want for the sake of wanting to have a better spiritual life. And that's the most common for anybody who goes into monastic center or anybody who joins a new monastic community today or order today. That green martyrdom is what they're doing. And really what they're doing is setting up spiritual exercises for themselves, which is what asceticism really means. If you go back to the desert fathers and mothers, they talk about asceticism. And asceticism really is just about exercises, spiritual exercises. And the reason we do exercises is to get fitter. And the more we stick to some kind of regime or routine, the fitter we get. The more we put in, the more we get out. And it's exactly the same with spiritual exercises too.
Yeah, one of your first chapters that stood out to me, you had the story of a person going to a gym and they arrive and people are reading books about working out or such, and they're sort of standing around, and you said, you know, or I think you were quoting someone who said contemporary Christianity is often a lot like a non-exercising health club. And you went on to, you know, the ancient Celts engaged in robust spiritual exercises. They weren't afraid of sweat. That really stood out to me.
Yeah, it's really significant, actually. Yeah, I'm quoting Kenneth McIntosh in his book, Water from an Ancient Well, which is an excellent introduction to Celtic Christianity in general. He does a chapter on green martyrdom, and that's how he starts it. It's a story, as I say, in my book, you know, he tells it in a much more humorous way than I've summarized it in mine. But yeah, so he, you know, this person is going into a gym and he wants to join it, and everyone's just kind of sitting around in the weights room reading books about weightlifting and sitting around by the exercise bikes reading books about cycling. And he says, "What's going on here? This is nonsense. What is this?" And the lady showing him around, McIntosh, says, "Oh yeah, this, you must be after one of those old fashioned gyms that makes people work out. You know, our people think life is hard enough without getting into a sweat and all that." And yeah, it's exactly that. You know, there's so much of contemporary Christianity and contemporary church which is just going along and having a nice time and not really understanding what it means to engage in something deeper. And it is only through spiritual disciplines that we gain a real depth of our spirituality. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's that, and this is sort of the critique that, you know, I at least was mentioning in the beginning of the sort of post-Constantine church, when, you know, it went from one of those communities where everyone was engaged. And of course, history is a little gray, right? So I might be simplifying it a little bit too much, but changed to sort of a thing where, hey, when everyone's a Christian, you just have a few religious leaders who everyone sort of comes just to listen to. You know, our seats are all pointed in one direction to see the one person who's speaking. And it speaks a lot to our minds, right? But I think for most of us, you know, we know, for example, that sugar is not good for us. We know, for example, that, you know, fish is probably healthier than red meat, for example. But the knowledge doesn't give us clear arteries, right? It doesn't keep us from getting diabetes. There's real practices that have to be brought in. And for me, that's become spiritual disciplines.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we find, or I find, in spiritual teachings is that a physical example can be a really good representation of what's actually going on spiritually as well. So actual physical discipline, a physical exercise, you know, is a really good example. So yes, you can read all the books and everything you want about and have all the knowledge you want about how your muscles work and how you can get fit. But unless you actually go out for a run, unless you actually get on the rowing machine or in the swimming pool or whatever it is you're going to do, nothing's going to change. So yes, having the theory is one thing, but yeah, the actual exercises and discipline in engaging that in a regular practice is really important. And within that, of course, you know, just like physical exercise, the more you do it, the more regularly you do it, the more fit your body will become. One of the other things is that I often talk with people about in this is the connection with other people doing the same thing. So just like, you know, if I decided I wanted to become fitter and I decided I was going to go for a run at 6 o'clock every morning, the likelihood is that I'll do that for a little while and then it'll be drizzly and I'll be tired and, you know, I would have eaten too much the night before and I get up and go, yeah, not this morning. And then that might happen again and again. And after a little while, you just realize, oh, I haven't been out for ages. But if I was part of a running group and people were expecting me to be there and I was accountable to them and they were knocking on my door going, why haven't you been? Then I'm much more likely to keep that up. So to be part of a collective of people who are living like this, again, one of the things I love about being part of a new monastic community is that I'm part of a group of people who are committed to these spiritual exercises, to live by a monastic rule or way of life, as we call it in our community. And that's really important, I think, that sense of connectivity with others.
No doubt. I mean, we're made in the image of a community, right? The Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So we need others on the journey to encourage us, to challenge us, to keep us accountable, to help us along the way. But, you know, one of the other images that came to mind for me as you were speaking was, you know, if you start getting up at 6 a.m. and running every day, even with a partner or a group of friends, it's not like tomorrow you'll lose 30 pounds, right? It's going to take time. And I think that's sometimes hard for people too, who start getting into meditation or other prayer practice, say, well, I feel like nothing's happening, or I feel like I'm not doing it right. You know, what do you sort of, you know, advise people who are starting out on the path or who are a little bit of a way into it? How do you sort of encourage them on that?
Well, there's a movement here, sticking with the illustration of physical exercises, that there's a movement here, I don't know if it's the same over in the US, it's called Couch to 5K.
Yes, there is. Okay. Yep. There's an app
Okay, so basically, yeah, what they're doing is taking people who have mostly spent most of their life sitting on the sofa and getting them to a point where they can easily run 5K. Now, that doesn't happen in a week. You know, there's a gradual process. You know, first of all, you just get up off the sofa and then you run to the end of the street and back. So it's a similar practice. You know, you, if you're just starting out in something like the contemplative practice, you've used that as the example here. If you're just starting out in that, then don't set yourself the challenge of sitting in silence for an hour on your first day. It's not going to work. You're going to be demoralized. It's going to be hard. You're not going to make it. Start out with 3 or 4 minutes, probably with a guided meditation, either on an app like Insight Timer. That's the app that I use, and I record for them as well. So you can listen to me waffling on doing some guided meditations on there. And then, you know, start getting a bit longer. So basically, you know, once that period starts to feel like you get to the end of it and go, oh, I finished, stretch it for another couple of 3 minutes, and then stretch it for another, you know, so, and then you gradually move on in that, and it gets you fitter and fitter gradually. As you go on. So yeah, don't try and get up off the sofa and run 5K tomorrow morning. You know, use the app for Couch to 5K, use the apps for, you know, the spiritual disciplines. And as you said, you know, God has designed us to be as a community and a collective of people. You know, in the Old Testament, it was the people of God, it was Israel, it was a nation. In the New Testament, it was the ecclesia, the church, which is the body of Christ. It's not the physical building that you have on a Sunday morning, the congregation you go to. It's a wider concept than that, but we're always designed to be a people. So have others around you, take your time, and use others who are further on to help you to gain the best, you know. So like, again, physical exercise, you might get a coach to help you work out. They'll look at your body, they'll look at how tall you are, they'll look at how fit they think you are, and they'll give you a good process to get to somewhere that's a good level of fitness. So find someone to maybe go along with you on the journey, someone to, like a spiritual advisor or something, a soul friend, we call it in the Celtic tradition and in our community.
Yeah, we've recently started offering spiritual direction here, and it's been a powerful space when you're in that sort of one-on-one or even a group setting. To sort of be working through it with someone else, that can be really powerful. You know, one of the things that I keep sort of coming back to of Celtic Christianity and this white and green martyrdom idea was the fact that so much of it was influenced by the desert monastics, right? The desert mothers and fathers, but there are no deserts in Ireland, right? So they had to sort of find their own space to enter into that. So what did the space start to look like for them? Because if there weren't literal deserts, what did they begin to do?
Yeah, so this is one of the kind of Eastern Orthodox influences. So Eastern Orthodoxy's history goes right back to the Desert Fathers, and they still look at the writings and teachings of the Desert Fathers as their kind of main source of kind of early Christian writing. And interestingly, yes, we see that the sense of that influence in Ireland and particularly in Wales and Scotland as well, where actually in their own languages, there's still places in Ireland and Wales and Scotland that have the word desert as their place name in their own languages. So it shows that influence was really there. But yeah, what they had to do was take that practice, take that action and what they were doing, and then appropriate it into their own context. Because yes, there's not quite so many deserts in Ireland as there are in Egypt, where Anthony was and people like that, you know. So they had to start looking for spaces. So really, they took the concept and went, how can we appropriate this into our own context? And the actual reality of it was that it doesn't matter whether it's a physical desert to go to. They in Egypt, Anthony and others, and Syria and places like that, but they went to the deserts because that was the place that was outside the city. And so what they were looking for actually was a place to go to that was uninfluenced by the politics and the urbanization of culture, somewhere that was alone and separated. So they were looking for these separate places. So of course in Ireland and Scotland and Wales, their mountains and hills were the places that they went to. And so that's what they did. They went out to these kind of right out on the edge places. And some of them literally were out on the edge. I mean, I don't know if you know much about something like Skellig Michael, which is a tiny island off the west coast of Ireland itself, which has one of the best preserved 8th and 9th century monastic centres, a collection of beehive huts, all made of stone, dry stone walled, beehive-shaped huts. If you're a fan of Star Wars, then it's Skellig Michael was where Luke Skywalker was filmed in the latter newer films, the old
it's
Luke
funny
Skywalker.
That's how I was picturing it. So
that's actually where it's filmed. It's filmed in the monastic centre from the 8th and 9th century down in the Skellig Michael. Or some of it is, you know, when they start blowing the doors off and things, that's a studio set. They didn't let them do that to the 8th century stuff. But they literally went out to nowhere. They went out to be separated. And that was a big part of it. So they lived this out, but just like the desert monastic, which is where monasticism started, they did it in a rhythm and engaged with people. The solitude and the engagement of mission was a good balance and a rhythm to go to. There's a wonderful poem written by a guy called Andy Rain that's often attributed to St. Aidan of Lindisfarne because it's written in the Northumbria Community Celtic Daily Prayer Book under the Aidan liturgy section, and it's written as if Aidan's saying it, but actually it's a modern poem. But it talks about the rhythm of the tide. So Lindisfarne is a tidal island. So when it's at low tide, it's dry land between the island and the mainland. Then at high tide, it's cut off and it's an island.
Oh, wow.
So this poem talks about the rhythm of the tides. So at low tide, you know, it talks about going out into the world. And then at high tide, coming back into a presence of God. So it says, let me be cut off and alone with you, God. And then as the tide changes, let me go out into the world, but let me be drawn back into you as the tide comes back. And that sense of rhythm of isolation and interaction was seen quite evidently in a lot of the stories of the Celtic saints.
Yeah, the importance of that rhythm, I like it. At one point in the book, you talk about the different monastic rules, and I wish we had time to go into everything, but you know, a reason for people to go buy the book and talking about committing to a rhythm of prayer throughout the day. And I think that can be a really helpful practice because as we talk about, you know, appropriating the desert into a new context to sort of figure out what does it look like here, you know, for most people listening to this, you know, they are married, you know, and some people have small children or, you know, a full-time job already. And they think, well, I can't move out to an, you know, as much fun as it may sound, you know, with all the craziness of my life. And I'd like to move to an island sometimes, you know, even to come back, of course, but to get that break. I can't, right? I can't just go and do that.
Yeah.
So how do we sort of go to a second level of bringing the desert into your life, no matter your situation, no matter your job status, no matter your family status, no matter your obligations, there's some good ways, right, that we can incorporate it even in the midst of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one you just mentioned is a great place to start. Those having those kind of monastic points of prayer throughout the day, incredibly good place to start. So the easiest way to do it is actually to kind of put it in places where it's, or you've already got stuff set up. So for example, the order that I belong to, Community of Aid in the Hill, that we have the commitment to do 4 prayer points a day. So your day is intentionally punctuated with prayer at the same time each day. This doesn't mean you can't pray any other time of day, can't do spontaneous prayer other times of day, but actually to intentionally punctuate your day at the same time every day with points of prayer is actually really helpful. It's the same, you get back into the spiritual exercises, it helps us, a sense of routine and a sense of rhythm into our life. So the 4 points of the day that we commit to is morning, midday, evening, and night prayer. So simply, you know, if people are saying, oh, I'm going to struggle to fit those 4 points in, my suggestion is always, well, you know, so basically it's when you get up, with lunch, with dinner, before you go to bed. Now, we already have those 4 points in most of our days. Most of us have, you know, we get up in the morning and most of us will stop for lunch and have dinner, and most of us will have a moment before we go to bed. So we've already got those 4 points in our day. So what you can do is actually intentionally add prayer into that. So it's not just a quick, I need to just say a prayer now, or this is my quiet time. You know, this isn't the quiet time where you use your Bible reading notes or what have you. This is times where you know, intentionally stopping and pausing to take a breath, to recenter, to refocus on God, and just to kind of reorient yourself to get on with your day again. So begin your day, get up in the morning, start your day with a bit of a prayer. And, you know, I have liturgy books, but I also have just like a 1-paragraph prayer for each of those 4 points that I keep on my phone. So if I haven't got much time, or, you know, if I'm in the middle of a meeting or something like that and it goes off, then I might just read that prayer, just a little paragraph, maybe 8 or 9 lines that I repeat each time. And then, you know, as you're sitting down with lunch, as you're sitting down with dinner and just before you go to bed, intentionally punctuating your days with prayer. And it's incredibly helpful, and it's been part of the monastic tradition since the beginning. In fact, it's been part of Christianity and Judaism. You know, Daniel did it. It talks about it in the Psalms. Paul talks about the times of prayer, the hours of prayer. Peter and John, they talk about the hours of prayer that they went to do. You know, it's always been a part of the Judaic Christian tradition, including monasticism. And that incredibly simple rhythm in your day can make a significant difference. To your whole being and your whole flow of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a general rule of thumb that if something's been in our tradition for thousands of years, we should at least consider that.
At least give it a go, yeah.
Yeah, billions, trillions of people have practiced this for thousands of years. So there must be something to it. And I mean, that's why a book like yours is perfect. You know, pick this up for Lent. It's not expensive. And hey, maybe you can't, maybe you just read the descript, you know, the prayer at one part, you do the practice, and you can sort of use that even as a guide, so you don't have to just make it up. I know at Rua Space, we have lots of guided prayers, but there's so many books out there, and you've written so many of them that can sort of help give you something to focus on. Even if it is, hey, there's one prayer each day as one of the sections, use that at each part of your day and then see how it comes back out. See how it affects your day. See how it impacts you. And of course, there's many other practices we can incorporate in, but that's a good one. In my seminary, they used to have every 3 hours, a bell would go off and we would pause just for 5 or 10 seconds. And that was it. It was just that rhythm to come back to.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. So I listened to numerous teachings from various different peoples, and there's a guy who's just died, actually, a guy called Thich Nhat Hanh, who's arguably one of the kind of the leading, or was the leading teaching of mindfulness, Buddhist mindfulness, to the Western Church. And he said he grew up in a village where he could hear the monastic bell, and everybody in the village used to stop when the bell went, just to breathe, to refocus, and then carry on, like you say, just 3 or 4 breaths and then carry on. And he said when he started traveling, particularly to the West in the latter years, he really missed that, and he didn't know how to engage with that because he felt it missing. You know, it's a bit like going back to the exercise. You know, once you're used to doing the exercise, if you miss a couple of days, your body really feels it. And so spiritually, if you're used to doing these exercises, if you miss a few days or if you miss the prayer times, your spirit really feels it. And so his answer was, as he traveled around the West, he decided that there were so many people with mobile phones that he was going to use other people's mobile phones, like the monastic bell. So when he was traveling, if anybody else's mobile phone went off, he would stop and breathe and do some mindfulness and just be aware of where he was.
Oh, that's good.
I think that's a brilliant idea. So we can use all sorts of different tools to be able to do that for ourselves.
Man, and that's so good to use something that is such a distraction to say, I'm actually going to sort of transform that into a moment of mindfulness. That's a good one to think about. I mean, hey, I think I might steal that. You know, when I hear a phone go off, it's going to be a moment to return. But those rhythms really do sort of sink in. And I'm reminded of the parable of the sower or the parable of the soil. And how do we sort of form those, you know, become soil where deep roots can form? And I think it's these rhythmic habits that sort of till that space to allow the spirit to, you know, constantly be mindful of the Holy Spirit, constantly return to God, to just take a moment to breathe. I think that's what makes that space in our lives.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important word there, making the space in our lives for God, because we can so easily become over busy and overwhelmed, even or maybe especially those people that work in the churches. You know, you kind of assume that the people who work in churches are doing this stuff or at least engaging with God because that's what they're paid for, that's what their job is, or, you know, even if it's volunteer. But actually, yeah, we need to create that space for God. We need to stop to create the space for God, stop our brains, stop our bodies, stop our motion and momentum in our life internally and externally, and create that space for God. Yeah,
that's a really helpful practice. So of course, you know, I would encourage people again, you know, to check out the book, because you have some great practices and great insights there that could help. You know, it's, I know we're a couple weeks into Lent, but there's still a lot to go. And of course, you don't have to skip the early chapters. You could go back to them at another point in time. But Brother Cassie, you know, I could talk to you forever about this stuff, and I just love your work and have appreciated it so much, but I want to honor your time. And so I'm just going to ask, what might be a final word of encouragement you might offer for people on this journey?
I think an encouragement would be that you're not alone on this journey. There is a growing number of people who are encountering this way of being, encountering this way of expressing their Christian faith, their depth of spirituality. So I would encourage you to, you know, if this is where you're feeling led, to engage with or try and encounter groups of people doing it, new monastic communities, or, you know, just small groups within local areas. Don't try and do this on your own. And be encouraged by others. That's what I think I would encourage folks to do. Yeah,
that's so key. We cannot do it on our own. That's so true. Yeah. A community can be so encouraging, such a blessing. And if people want to find out more about your work and what you're up to, where can we send them?
So most of what I do will be found on waymarkministries.com. And you'll find all the books on there, and you'll find links to buy them and things as well. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, we will have that in the description below. Brother Cassian, thank you as always. It's been an honor again. Appreciate your time. Blessings on the rest of your work. And yeah, just thank you so much.
Bless you and your rough radio as well. Bless you. Amen.
Hey friends, Phil here again. Before you go, I just wanted to say thank you once again for joining us for this episode. I pray that you were blessed, challenged, and encouraged. I do highly recommend go check out some of the links in the description below to check out more of David's work, to find his wonderful books, to engage this specific book on Lent. And while you're there, you will also see links to set up a call for spiritual direction with me, to check out Patreon and the really great series that we have going on there, as well as our YouTube and Christian yoga membership. So friends, thank you again for being here with us again today. Until next time, grace and peace be with you.